Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha's way is incomparable. I vow to attain it. Sorry for keeping you waiting. How's everyone today? So it is said that the awakened person is obstructed neither by being or non-being. And this is what's meant by liberation. Neither being obstructed by being or non-being, this is also samadhi. He, she is also free from all defilements and attachments. It's like rain falling on the gentle blue ocean. Remaining within the mind of non-action, he or she has followed the stream and reached the marvel. This is like describing nirvana. For he or she, there's nothing that is not sacred. He or she could be truly said to be beyond all things. We've talked a lot about it as attachment. I like the term obstructed too. Not being obstructed by our thinking, how we perceive things through our personality, our experience, our karmic life. I sometimes think about my practice like peeling an onion. Every time I get a layer gone, there's another one. But every layer is a little bit different, a little bit sweeter, a little bit closer to the core. The outermost layer is so gritty and dirty, you would discard it because it would not taste very good. That's kind of like precepts, why we have this moral aspect of practice, so that we can clean off that dirty layer and get to the sweet onion on the inside. I guess the reason I'm talking about onions, I've discovered this bag of organic onions that are just the best. And I've been putting them in everything. So we don't leave this world because we're liberated. We affect our surroundings differently. We're not producing suffering for ourselves and for others. We've put that down because our minds are like a clear mirror. And we just reflect things as they are, and we don't have to make something out of them to fit into some idea of how things are, because we've put ideas down. We have ideas, of course, but they don't run us. We have karma. This body is shaped in this particular way. I happen to be a man in this incarnation. That's the way it is. That's what I'm dealt with. And each of us is like that. Plus, there's all the more familiar things, mom and dad and grandpa and grandma, husband and children, and all these things, these relationships that we have, all these karmic connections. How can we be liberated inside of all that? When we put down our expectations of what our spouse should be like, then we have the freedom to see them with fresh eyes. And maybe some of that suffering is alleviated. Or someone you work with. Or the President of the United States. One of the things that they talk about in Buddhism is being a bodhisattva is kind of like being a thief. You don't advertise that you're saving all sentient beings. You do it stealthily, undercover, of just being an ordinary human being. I've often been bewildered by that. Why is it? Why do they say that? Why do they say to be stealthy? What does that mean? Don't you want everybody to know you're healing the planet? Don't you want everybody to get on board? I didn't understand. What does that mean? What does that mean? I knew it had something to do with humility and something to do with not taking personal responsibility for something that is beyond personality. And then I began to recognize, being in the position I'm in, that putting out there what you know on deaf ears, it's not helping. So stealthily, you greet someone with a clear mind like space, without any judgment, total freedom, letting them be who they are. And unbeknownst to them, they have flowered a little bit more in being who they are, because they're not confronted by an idea that they don't relate to, or a costume that doesn't fit their culture, or a et cetera, et cetera. Nature is a great example. In all of its diversity and beauty, in all these different forms, there's an equanimity to it. There's no dominance, as much as we like to put dominance on nature and express it as though there is dominance. But that's only from our human view. We're not really seeing how it actually is. You know, survival of the fittest, for example. How convenient for us to think that. That's kind of like patting ourselves on the back. Is it really survival of the fittest? Or is there something much more going on there in how things are balancing in the long run term and in a larger picture? Karma, you know what I was saying about karma? When you get a little distance from things, you can see how they actually are. Take a breath and then figure out how to be with it. When you're in the midst of things, it's really hard to take that breath and take a step back and see how best to deal with the situation. I think in conflict resolution, that's probably something that comes in real handy. So I really believe wholeheartedly and am totally convinced that for each one of us, awakening is a reality, and there is something to awaken to. So even though at times our practice is quite difficult, there is something happening. I know it, and I think you each know it too, or you wouldn't keep showing up. It's a good day. I was in New Orleans at a festival, a music festival. I was sitting on a curb eating some jambalaya or something. And along comes a monk, a Buddhist monk, who knows from where, came walking by. And I looked at him and I said, "Whoa, Buddhas, Buddhas everywhere." And he said, "It's a beautiful day." That was all we said to each other. That made my whole trip. The music was good too, and so was the jambalaya. All right.
So I have something. I'm going to be a Michael and ask a bunch of questions. I started to read the Diamond Sutra. And Nancy, you're right. I should have just read it fast and done it all through at once, because I got through like the first couple and I'm like, wait, hold on. What does this mean? Anyway, out of nowhere, the mind comes forth. I'm stuck on that. Like, what? I guess my question is, what is it he's referring to? Is the mind the clear mind, or is it my current mind that's filled with thoughts and all these? I guess I was just wondering, like, what does that mean? Out of nowhere, the mind comes forth. Does that mean we've achieved enlightenment, or that we see our thoughts constantly interrupting our ability to do that?
Well, I guess it depends on who's looking. The mind could refer to mind with a capital M, as in unmovable mind. Mind clear like space, And I don't know exactly at what point you're referring to in this, in the sutra. So I would have to hear the above line, below line, kind of to put it into perspective. So I can't give you an answer as to whether it's talking about deluded mind, the kind of mind that comes and goes like all phenomena, or whether we're talking about mind like Buddha nature. So the answer is neither and both, as the rest of the Diamond Sutra would say.
That actually makes sense, like as much as it does and it does, which I guess is the point of that Diamond Sutra. It was very interesting. I've been rereading it and just led me down another path of my husband and I have been reading. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's spelled K-O-A-N, Koans?
Koan, yeah, Koan, sure.
Yeah, we've been reading a couple of those that we found, and I'm like, well, these are interesting.
Yeah, koans are interesting because referring to what you just said about mind coming from nowhere, koans show you that when you solve them. And they also show you that when you don't solve them. Good question. Good question.
So I was, when you were talking about humility and nature, the other day I saw a TED Talk about this Canadian woman, Suzanne Simard. And she is a biologist, and she discovered that trees talk to themselves. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And that makes you really humble. Like, how little we know, how little we are aware of, really. And so I was thinking, we keep on talking about going again. It's the same thing, you know, we're going to go to nature and fix it and change it and do all these things, when actually, if we were quiet enough and still enough, we would do exactly what Suzanne Simard did, which is actually listening to what they are saying to us. And so, you know, I'm making that connection right now. So this ideas and opinions and everything we have block, like you were saying, block this capacity to listen what is wanting to be told to us.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
What are the trees saying?
Oh, the trees, they have a whole way of connecting under the surface with each other. There is actually in the Equatorian Amazon, there's an anthropologist who lived with the people in the, and they can actually interpret the language of trees. But the work of Suzanne Simard is kind of more basic than that. The trees connect with each other, and they pass all kinds of information about how to survive, but they are also creating communities in clusters. Like the birch and the pine do not communicate with each other, but the birch and the evergreen or whatever they do. I mean, it's fascinating. It's a TED Talk.
It is. I heard it a couple of years ago on Radiolab with NPR. So I just pasted the link in the chat there, but I've heard that. It's incredible. They have like an entire neural network of like tree.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible.
Yeah. You know, and we just plaster it there and say a tree, you know, it's so much more.
I don't know if it's the same person or not, but there's also, I think it's on Netflix, a documentary about trees talking also that I tuned into.
It's probably the same one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would like to share a book I just read. It's called The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. And it's about a woman who has a mysterious virus and can't move. She has to lay in bed for a year. and a friend of hers digs up some violets and puts them in a pot with a snail by her bed, and how she observes this snail in nature by just being quiet and observing. It's a very sweet book. It's very short. It has haiku in it. It has poetry in it. It's very well written. And I highly recommend it based on what we've been talking about today. The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. Very comforting.
So while we're recommending things, in the New York Times this morning, I read an article, I think it was in this past week, maybe on the 4th, called Owling. And it's an article by a woman who went into the woods in Maine with her son to go owling. And she apparently has written other articles with a sort of spiritual bent about being present to what's going on in the moment. And this article was very interesting and very sweet and very clear about our relationship to nature, and just to what Veronica was saying about putting down all our mental human activity that we are so caught up in, to take a moment to really be present to the magnificence and, you know, immense beauty of nature that we're part of. And it's not just humbling, but opens up our minds to all the possibilities that we're not thinking of when we're so limited by this making that we're all caught up in all the time. So, and it's going back to the retreat when I suggested we go out in nature for an hour, you know, that was my idea there too. It's about expanding our horizons in terms of, and putting down and cleansing just the stuff we're caught up in, cleansing it out so that you can just watch the snail or listen to the trees talking. It's beautiful. Yeah, glad we're talking about it. Hi, Peter.
Hey. To me, stealth kind of implies an intent not to be noticed.
Yeah.
As opposed to just deep listening.
Mm-hmm.
Just being there.
Yeah.
The intent to do something may get in the way of what you want to do.
Yeah, doing something stealthily without intent, though, is different than having the intent to have an effect. Acting without being noticed.
I think the if you're too intent on doing something good, you're separate from the situation already.
Yes. Yes. Very true. It's a good point.
But while we're sharing things, this week I ran across the Australian Aboriginal practice of Dadiri, which is deep listening. And it's like, I heard a recording. And to me, it sounded like 40,000 years of Shikantaza, just really sitting down, waiting and listening. It's part of the culture.
Yeah. The great mystery, deep listening. Wonderful. I've always admired, and I'm sure you do, haiku or lots of different poets and Zen stories and Zen poetry that is so direct about experience, what's happening right now, and leaves you with the effect that we just had by talking about deep listening, you know, kind of leaves your mind open and not taken down a path you necessarily didn't want to go down, but leaves you open to what's next. White clouds over a mountain. One of my favorite ones is white clouds hold the lonely mountains in embrace. It's a nice morning. Thank you.